Welcome to Cannabis House Call. This podcast is committed to educating the discerning public and will make the case for cannabis as medicine. Your hosts, Dr. Les Matthews and Dr. Hal Altman, are physicians with advanced degrees in medical cannabis. The Cannabis House Call is sponsored by Compassionate Certification Centers, or CCC. CCC is a physician-owned and leading medical marijuana certification center that helps patients receive legal access to medical marijuana in Pennsylvania. Having certified more than 100,000 patients across the state through its in-office and virtual telehealth appointments, CCC makes the process of getting a Pennsylvania medical marijuana card fast and easy. Learn more at cccregister.com.
Hello there, and welcome back to Cannabis House Call. I'm Dr. Les Matthews, a physician trained in cannabis medicine, and I am joined in this podcast by my colleague, Dr. Hal Altman, also a physician with an advanced degree in medical cannabis. It is our goal to provide grassroots, fundamental, truthful, and solid information to our listening public about all things cannabis. In our last episode, we began a discussion of the endocannabinoid system, the system within our bodies that's affected by cannabis, both that that's produced by our own bodies, the endocannabinoids, as well as those that are consumed from external sources, the phytocannabinoids. So Hal, can you take us back a little bit and give us a little more detail regarding the cannabinoids that are produced by our own bodies?
Sure. We spoke the last time, there's a bit of an irony. Cannabis has been recognized as being an effective medicine for thousands of years. And in the 20th century, it was actually part of the pharmacopoeia and used as tinctures for a variety of ailments. And because of the political milieu that we found ourselves in the 20th century, cannabis fell out of favor as medicine, was taken off the pharmacopoeia. And ironically, over the last 60 years, we've discovered that it indeed has a basis as a medicine. And that basis is really connected to and defined by the endocannabinoid system. The endocannabinoid system was discovered because Dr. McCullum, an Israeli researcher, was interested in exploring how THC affected the brain and the body. And in pursuing that, he was able to find an entire system that is responsible for maintaining balance or homeostasis within the human body. So the endocannabinoid system is a system that is comprised of endocannabinoids, that is, chemicals that are produced by the brain that interact with a receptor within the central nervous system. That receptor is CB1. And there's also a secondary receptor called CB2. And CB2 is less distributed in the central nervous system, more distributed in non-nervous system tissues like the spleen and the tonsils, the GI tract, and a number of other systems throughout the body. The endocannabinoids have very long, very difficult to pronounce names. And so by convention, we use abbreviations. The first is AEA, and it is also called anandamide, which is Sanskrit for divine bliss. So it's the messenger in the central nervous system that interacts with CB1, the same receptor that THC interacts with. 2-AG is an endocannabinoid that's produced in the periphery of the body. It affects CB2 receptors and helps to control some of the immunologic effects of the endocannabinoids, as well as some of the GI effects. And as we talk more about disease states, we'll be able to understand the disease states based upon where these receptor sites are located and where the endocannabinoids are produced. And the third and final component of the endocannabinoid system are enzymes that are specifically produced to remove the endocannabinoids. So there is a specific enzyme that's produced to remove anandamide or AEA, and there's a second enzyme produced that is meant to remove or to destroy 2-AG. So with these enzymes, the endocannabinoid system is able to respond to an imbalance in its homeostasis by the production of endocannabinoids. The endocannabinoids attach to the receptor sites CB1 or CB2, and then the enzymes are able to destroy and remove the endocannabinoids from the receptor sites and reestablish homeostasis.
So Hal, we've, I think, painted a pretty clear picture for the audience about the difference between the endocannabinoids, those that are produced by our own bodies, and the phytocannabinoids that are derived from external plant sources and can be ingested in the body in a number of forms. Can you explain why we really don't get a euphoric effect from the cannabinoids that are produced by our own body, the endocannabinoids, whereas we do from some of the phytocannabinoids, particularly THC?
Sure. When we talk about euphoria or high, we're talking about central nervous system effects and the primary parts of the endocannabinoid system that are involved in that are the endocannabinoid AEA and the CB1 receptor. And then there's an enzyme that eliminates or destroys AEA on the receptor site once its action is complete. THC is somewhat related chemically to AEA, but it's different enough that it has a different effect on the CB1 receptor. And so it has a stronger affinity for engaging that receptor, so it stays on the receptor site longer than AEA does. And THC is not affected by the enzyme that destroys AEA. So THC ends up having a stronger effect when it's engaged on the receptor site, and it's not able to be destroyed or pushed off that receptor site as readily as the enzyme system that takes care of AEA in the endocannabinoid system. So it's the extra stimulation and the duration of that extra stimulation that produces the high. AEA is thought to have somewhat of an effect, almost like an endorphin or an enkephalin that gives you a sense of well-being, but not necessarily the sense of intoxication or being high.
So that leads us to the potential for cannabis to have medicinal purposes for a variety of conditions, many of which, because of a number of factors, mostly regulatory, you know, research has only begun to scratch the surface on understanding what those uses might be. But can you give our audience an overview of how this interaction between cannabinoids and the cannabinoid receptors in the body might play a role in treating various disease states?
Sure. So the theory, at least on this, is that not dissimilar to some of the other organ systems in the body, that you can have too much or too little of the substance that's required to keep that organ system functioning well. And with endocannabinoids, that means that we may not be producing enough of the AEA or 2-AG endocannabinoids. There may not be enough receptor sites in the area of the body that their actions are needed, or the enzymes may not be appropriate and therefore produce either too much stimulation or not enough. And so the balance of the system is what many researchers are looking at that may contribute to disease states. And so by manipulating the components of the system, it would be, I guess, a more natural way to control the endocannabinoid system than something from the outside. So the phytocannabinoids, THC and CBD in particular, certainly can help to reestablish the balance that may be missing but they're much more difficult to manipulate and control than if we were able to manipulate the individual components of the endocannabinoid system.
So what disease states do you see as being particularly susceptible or amenable to have cannabinoids have an impact?
The two classic ones that are discussed by researchers are chronic pain and inflammation.
You know, we've heard a lot, you know, in the past 5 or 10 years about the opioid crisis and news items almost every day about egregious behavior on the part of pharmaceutical companies and large lawsuits and settlements. Obviously was a big problem, and pain management remains a challenge for both physicians who treat it and patients who experience it. And the question is, does cannabis have the potential to play a role there and be a valuable treatment modality for patients with chronic pain?
The answer to that is yes. We're just not sure how effective it can be because we've not been able to do the definitive studies because of the Schedule 1 status that cannabis currently has. So we're not entirely sure, but there have been very promising trials in other parts of the world where concomitant use of cannabis products with opiates decreases the overall need for opiates in controlling pain and makes it less likely that there will become opiate addiction. So chronic pain is one of the conditions that's been recognized as being a fruitful place to look for the application of cannabis medicine. Likewise, some of the chronic inflammatory diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, some of the other autoimmune diseases, there is a hope that by manipulation of the endocannabinoid system, reestablishing the tone or the balance of that system will mitigate some of the symptoms that are characteristic of chronic inflammatory states.
So the combination of cannabis with perhaps more traditional pharmacological approaches to chronic pain or inflammatory diseases may have an added or more beneficial effect than either one alone. Fair?
That's the theory, yes. And so probably, I don't think we've talked about this less, but maybe just talk a little bit about the location of the receptor sites in the central nervous system and how they're effective. So when there's an imbalance, let's just say that there is a chronic pain imbalance. So somebody's got disabling back pain, and that pain is realized both from the peripheral nervous system, the nerves that supply the area that is painful, as well as the central nervous system where the perception of that pain exists. And so with the location of CB1 in the central nervous system, when there's an imbalance, when there's an overload of the pain stimulus, there is a signal that's sent to CB1, and that signal in the central nervous system is AEA. It engages the receptor site. There is a message sent to the internal sites of the cell that produce secondary neurotransmitters, that is, compounds within the neurons in the central nervous system that control our perception of pain. So by reestablishing that perception of pain, the endocannabinoid is able to send out signals that lessen the secondary transmitters that tell us that we're having pain and the balance is reestablished.
Hal, this has been a great discussion, and I think it's probably a good place to stop this episode on. And when we come back, we're going to take a deeper dive into talking more about the phytocannabinoids and get into more specifics about the better known ones and their role potentially as medicine. Again, to wind up our show today, we have a question from a listener, and it has to do with understanding what the heck Delta 8 THC is. And to paraphrase this, the Listener says, a buddy of mine came over with Delta 8. He said it's perfectly legal. He called it THC light and that it would have benefits like THC, but he bought it at his local gas station. And is that okay? So how can you tackle that and just give some color to that whole scenario?
I'll try. So THC is Delta 9 THC, and Delta 9 simply refers to chemical signature within the compound. Delta 8 is similar to, but has a chemical structure that's a little bit different than 9. But it engages CB1 to a lesser degree than Delta 9 THC does. So it produces less euphoria, less of a high than Delta 9 does. What producers are doing is when you harvest hemp, you start to extract some of the cannabinoids that we talked about earlier from it. There's a very small segment of Delta 8 that is part of both cannabis as well as hemp. Hemp, by definition, has less than 0.3% THC in it, and so it's considered to be a legal crop. And so what the processors have done is they've extracted the Delta 8 from the hemp plant, have basically concentrated it, and they're selling it now as an alternative to Delta 9 THC. So again, the whole idea of it being THC light is the fact that it has less affinity for CB1 and it doesn't produce the intense euphoria that you see with Delta 9.
And just to embellish just a little bit more before we wrap up, we're going to get into, again, the legal issues in more detail, but hemp was legalized, defined again as having less than 0.3% THC. And basically, it's a chemistry project to extract and concentrate Delta 8 from hemp. But since it's derived from hemp and since hemp's legal, theoretically, it's legal as well. And that's the loophole. The other word of caution is that there is absolutely no regulatory or administrative oversight right now over the production of Delta 8. So a guy could be making it in a vat in his garage, theoretically, and mixing in pesticides and heavy metals and all kinds of bad things and selling it to the local drugstore. And you as the consumer have no assurance of any quality control that has been imparted to that product, which differs, again, from legalized cannabis in a state-run or state-supervised dispensary. So it's buyer beware in terms of the product, what's in it, what the concentration is, and so on. And I think our general advice to people is to stay away. Thank you, Hal. Again, enjoyed the conversation, and we'll look forward to continuing in our next episode of Cannabis House Call.
Thank you, Les. See you next time.
All information, material, and content on this podcast is for general information and educational purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for professional and/or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment by a qualified physician or healthcare provider. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and any materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. Cannabis House Call does not offer personal health or medical advice. If you have a medical emergency, call your doctor or call 911 immediately.